Dr. Jansel ended his explanation in this vein, when I enthusiastically replied, "In my opinion, Dr. Jansel, this is advanced socialism that softens life in all its sectors, even facilitating the moral and physical recovery of those less favored by fortune. This moral and physical recovery to which you allude, we also try to do it in our hospitals here on this planet."
"But you have hospitals," I said in astonishment.
"Oh yes. The inevitable consequences of previous lives still impact on us here. I'm going to give you a tour of a hospital so that you can see some cases where recovery is difficult. Although it's rare, certain individuals bring with them a troubled mind and remnants of such a nature that, in the future, they will be incompatible with normal life on the planet. Our ardent desire to remedy this leads us to apply all the resources at our disposal." Chapter 7, Visiting a Hospital. When the conversation was over, we got up and left that splendid room, of vast dimensions, to reach the wide pavement of the majestic avenue. On our way out, we made use of one of the video phone sets at the door of the residence. Dr. Jansel spoke to some distant person, and I thought that he had asked for a driver to take us to the hospital area. However, my assumption was wrong, because then, approaching one of the columns, he activated a device and immediately one of the larger long-distance vehicles pulled up in front of us. We got on this collective bus and I met two other inhabitants of that marvelous city and, apart from two successive stops to drop off these passengers, we made the journey in about 15 minutes. At the end of this journey, during which I took the opportunity to observe everything I could, we got off and headed towards a huge group of houses, all oval in shape, where the hospitals and inpatient sections were located. We reached the courtyard of the hospital, which was vast in its proportions, where I saw countless devices perched on platforms. Many of them were real halves of flying saucers with a round bed in the center, close to the floor, big enough to accommodate about 10 people. On these devices you could also see a larger tube crossing the floor to project outwards, in the same way as a very large cone. Around this bed, located inside the half discs, on a higher level, there was a kind of tripod with overlapping tubes of various sizes, which had gaps with slats in the gaps, imitating our blinds. I soon began to wonder about the purpose of this installed imperfect halves of flying discs, and I was told that they were health flying discs intended to take patients to various altitudes, according to the recommended treatment. Dr. Jansel explained further, "There are many layers in the atmosphere whose therapeutic elements are utilized by us to cure patients. Thus, according to the diagnosis, the patient is taken to a pre-established height, where he stays for a certain number of hours, in order to benefit from the natural elements inherent in that atmospheric layer. There are cases where a patient needs two or more elements at the same time in order to recover. In this way, the patient is taken to the layer where elements A and B are located, and we send him from here, by means of waves received by that external cone, element C. Stored in suitable containers, we have distinct and indispensable elements for the cure and, when necessary, we project them into the rectifying chambers of the apparatus which is responsible for acting in a dosed manner on the patient's depleted physique, in line with what he assimilates at the preset altitude. Without realizing that any suggestion of mine should naturally have been foreseen by such intelligent creatures, I boldly made the following statement: wouldn't it be more interesting to apply these different elements that are already stored down here? Not taking my impertinence into account, my interlocutor replied attentively, "That would indeed be ideal, but the captured elements lose 40% of their efficacy. So the treatment of a few days could go on for months. We are expecting an improvement in the process soon, which will undoubtedly greatly improve the current method." Speaking about the therapeutic power of the atmosphere, Dr. Jansel said, "We have observed, on planet Earth, individuals who contract the tuberculosis bacillus by practicing harmful excesses in contaminated environments. Let's take, for example,
the aviator who stays on the ground contaminated by the bacillus, everything would indicate that he would be a serious tuberculosis patient within 6 months. However, after a few days, he takes his aeroplane and climbs into the air, where at a certain height, without knowing it, he comes into contact with the beneficial elements of the atmosphere. As they pass through the air at that height, the bacilli feel constrained, oppressed and immediately try to leave the attacked body, only to be easily destroyed at that elevation. Does this mean that we would avoid many illnesses if we could only make use of the beneficial atmospheric therapies? Of course, earthly man would avoid many ailments if they were to make good use of the elements contained in his atmosphere, which are vital to his life and organic constitution. The interesting thing is that I'm feeling very well, but I notice that there is a significant difference between this atmosphere and ours, I said. In response to my assertion, Dr. Janzel replied, I'll try to give you an explanation. He went on to talk about the subject, more or less as follows. The Earth's atmosphere, although gaseous, the Earth's atmosphere is heavy and coarse. It's immovable and unstable, it moves under different pressures, requiring Earthlings to breathe with an exaggerated volume, consequently, it forces them to constantly move their thorax and belly. In fact, this is an ingenious aspect of nature because in ancient times earthly animals were endowed with enormous lungs, true bellows that allowed them to live among the harmful or pestilential gases. We must not forget that all organic formation is congenital to the environment and that every living being is matter. Matter, in turn, is structured as a tangible and corporeal substance, according to the environment in which that being manifests itself in lives. Now, as our atmosphere is much more refined than that of planet Earth, we breathe without using our lungs, therefore, a condition specific to our environment. In his eagerness to make me conceive of this mechanism or organic phenomenon, he alluded to the ability of our rubber, the iron plates of our compressors, even glass, to retain air, even though they are porous materials. However, this is because the pores in these elements are much smaller than the particles that make up the Earth's atmosphere. If we tried to fill that same rubber chamber or that same compressor with our atmosphere, we would never achieve that because it is much thinner than the pores of that material. There is no wind here, much less what they call a hurricane or a cyclone. Our atmosphere is so subtle that a fan or an aeroplane propeller spinning in full motion would not cause an air current, and a lady who plied her fan would feel no coolness on her cheeks. Dr. Janzel concluded by saying, this makes you realize that our atmosphere, being hundreds of times thinner than that of planet Earth, is so subtle that we can breathe it without the existence of lungs. Although we don't have the same lungs as yours, we have an internal organ that replaces it satisfactorily. Therefore, there is a porous layer in our body absorbing the atmosphere in order to bring about the well-known process of hematosis. From what I was given to understand, I tried to ask the following question. So you mean that air is atmosphere in displacement and atmosphere is trapped air acting without producing expansion or pressure? The true conceptualization, in this case, is beyond your knowledge, but you will find that you are breathing atmosphere without your lungs working. This is because it is extremely thin. Seemingly wishing to put an end to this point, Dr. Janzel concluded, the Earth is far from being graced by God's gift. Having naturally expressed a certain doubt, Dr. Janzel asked me to close my mouth and then compressed my nostrils, inhibiting me from breathing. A few seconds passed before I felt a deep lack of air, forcing me to open my mouth. I was soon back to normal and, frankly, I had the impression that they didn't need to breathe at all, as I was the only one forced to practice breathing among the inhabitants of that splendid city. Patiently and full of complacency, the doctor returned to the subject, saying, you can inhale the most impure air, but your lungs accept the purest easily without feeling it. As for us, during our quick excursions on planet Earth, we breathe in what is pure in its atmosphere, filtering out or inhibiting our organic constitution from partly assimilating what is impure in it. It's like coarse and fine sand that, when sieved, lets only the finest sand escape. In our bodies a similar work of filtration, a kind of self-defense, which enables us to withstand the earthly atmosphere for a while, without any adaptation. For a better understanding, note that on Earth itself there are animals living satisfactorily on a tiny amount of oxygen and others enduring a noxiously saturated atmosphere for a long time. Fish, insects and a wide variety of amphibious animals that accommodate themselves in adverse environments, surviving for a long time without any terrible difficulties. Finally, the scientists of your world should make more accurate studies of the atmospheric layers that surround the Earth, and they would immediately find therapeutic elements that will prove useful. Such experiments could be carried out themselves. What's more, you yourself found that you didn't feel air on your face, but your lungs needed this atmosphere to breathe. Is this treatment in the atmospheric layers the only therapy used here? Not far from it. Other methods are used, based on the projection of rays and gases as indicated. Sometimes medicines are given by mouth, but injections are never used here. At this point we had already traveled through two sections of the hospital, when I was invited to go to the dressing room to witness the treatment of a wounded man who would be arriving shortly. We then went to the courtyard to wait for the arrival of an ambulance bringing the patient. As soon as we reached the outside of the hospital, the ambulance carrying the injured man arrived. He was gently lowered onto a small platform outside the building. He was just like the others. Despite being injured, he walked with a certain ease and presented a calm appearance, even though suffering could be sensed. He entered, carefully supported by two companions. The flesh of his shoulder was torn, which must have been causing him excruciating pain. Two doctors were waiting for him in the dressing room and he was soon placed on a kind of operating table and one of them began to examine him. At first, he began to look into the injured man's eyes, as if he was going to find a solution to the case there. While this was happening, the other surgeon used a kind of sponge to wipe away the blood that was oozing from the wound. Immediately, the surgeon picked up a lancet and began to search inside the wound, perhaps looking for severed veins. After this examination, which lasted a few seconds, he endeavored to manipulate the patient's shoulder to detect a possible fracture. I was watching the doctor's work, when a nurse entered the room, on a tray three unknown pieces of equipment. These were surgical devices to be used by the doctors, and they seemed so strange to me that I'll just describe them as I saw them, making a comparison with, of course, certain earthly objects. The first one looked very much like a half-liter bottle superimposed on a bulging tank, with a pronouncedly curved opening. A small circular box jutted out horizontally this. The other two devices differed in color, looked like huge metal spinning tops, fitted with a handle where you could see a slightly protruding button. While one of the doctors held the patient's arm, the other doctor took the first device by the handle and pointed it in the direction of the wound. I was amazed to see, in a matter of seconds, the separated parts of the wound, debris, blood and other impurities sucked into the bulging, transparent interior of the device. At the end of this operation, I noticed that they had carried out a preparatory asepsis and the patient's flesh had not only become clean, was looking slightly yellowish tone. Afterwards, the doctor took one of the other two devices by the handle, pointing it over the patient's shoulder and pressed a button. I watched as a jet of colorless liquid poured out of the nozzle of the instrument, like an aerosol spray. The liquid, thus projected, covered the entire wound site and, after a few minutes, the surgeon used the first device again, the sucker. He applied it again and more remnants of blood were also sucked into it, joining the first residues. The patient's flesh now seemed healthier to me and I believed the doctor had completed the disinfection. The nurse then handed the operating doctor the third instrument, as yet unused. This device emitted not a colorless liquid as before, but imperceptible jets of a sticky substance, which gradually accumulated in the cavities of the wound. It was the application of a plasma, obtained by integrating carefully preserved tissues, which the aforementioned device distributed over the wound in the form of an automatic plastic shield. Realizing my admiration, the doctor clarified that the plasma used was in fact a preparation of dissolved tissue, the matter of which fuses with the patient's flesh. It facilitated rapid recovery, it enabled the patient to feel nothing and the scar was no longer visible, disappearing completely. After this brief explanation, he moved on to a kind of mechanism that was near the table. There were two tubes emanating upwards from the floor, rising to a height of just over a meter, curving horizontally forwards, about 40 centimeters. At a parallel distance of half a meter apart, these tubes, entirely transparent, flared out at the ends with a circumference of about 35 centimeters. With a gesture, the doctor invited me to observe closely. I saw him insert his arms into the cylindrical mouths of those tubes, while at the same time pushing an internal lever. I could clearly see, his arms and hands were completely wet, as if they had been as if they were immersed in a basin of water. This operation didn't last long and as he removed his arms, I realized, on contact with the atmosphere, that everything was completely dry. He seemed to have carried out a preventive prophylaxis, their method for the customary cleaning of hands. That done, Dr. Jensel led me through the interior of the building to the other side and, when we arrived outside, he pointed to another neighboring building, saying, "This is where our probable criminals are housed." I stared at it with indescribable astonishment, but I couldn't answer. On the outside, it was a building like the others, but inside, it had numerous rooms and at each door two guards armed with some kind of weapon. It appeared to be something similar to our handheld, battery-operated lanterns, where the focal glass was replaced by a luminous material, full of holes like metal showerheads. We walked down a long corridor lined with round, side-opening doors to access a large room containing 16 children. "Here they are," he told me, pointing at them, stunned. Without realizing anything, I watched, he added, "These children have already been potential criminals and are carrying remnants, they have damage to their brains and, in the future, as adults, they may go on a rampage. Properly treated, they will be free from past influences and put in normal conditions to live with the other inhabitants, without being a danger." This is what was explained to me. As the visit continued, I was shown individual compartments, where their occupants, all adults, were possibly demented, and could never be recovered, despite the intense treatment they had undergone since childhood. Doctors define natural lesions of the brain as diseases of the soul contracted as a result of a past offenses. Physical illnesses are all curable within a longer or shorter period of time, because, as they say, they have the perfect resources to treat them. Armed with this explanation, I concluded that those incurable patients were suffering the consequences of wrongdoings or crimes committed in past lives in other worlds. "And what are those guards for?" I asked curiously. "The initial cycle of harmful manifestations of those in this state is unpredictable. At certain moment, they may want to flee or even attack, so the guards make use of the instrument they are carrying. It is a retainer capable of immobilizing the patient instantly, until their fit of insanity passes. Nobody physically touches them, even to make a diagnosis. In this case, we can dispense with the well-known method of palpation or the use of any kind of auscultation instrument, when we simply stare at the patient's eyes to conclude on their physical state. The eyes reflect the physical condition of the patient and due to their sensitivity, reveals which diseases and organs are affected." "Would this device applied to my person have the same effect?"
"Yes, your body would not be able to resist the immobilizing power of the ray. You would inevitably succumb." I thought to myself, isn't it an exaggeration for Dr. Jensel to say that I wouldn't be able to resist the immobilizing power of the device? After all, I don't perceive such a similarity between me and the physique of one of these patients that I wouldn't be able to resist. I decided to keep quiet and carry on. We were finishing this conversation and, as we reached to the opposite side of that strange sanatorium, I came across a vast forest, whose trees caught my attention because of their different particularities. Chapter 8 Applied Psychotherapy. We entered a large park where thousands of leafy trees, whose trunks and branches were light brown in color and their leaves had a yellowish appearance as if they were almost dry, toasted by the sun. The profusely flowering trees displayed huge blooms the size of a dinner plate, in the center of which stood four white oval petals, arranged in the shape of a cross. From the center of the petals rose beautiful, slender pistils. These trees were therapeutic and were true tonics for health. Their emanations actively contributed to the healing and restoring the sick, according to my inseparable guide. I was delighted to see birds appearing which nonchalantly approached us without any sign of fear from all sides as if they had come to welcome us. They didn't have wings, but membranes on the side of their backs. They could jump with a natural facility and without any effort they could leap distances of up to 20 meters. They didn't have feathers, but they varied in color. They were pleased with our presence. They emitted notes and trills that hissed in my ears. Some twittered clearly and happily, giving us a pleasant sensation and pleasure in listening to them. Others, with their trilling very similar to our earthly birds, amused themselves restlessly, jumping to the top of the houses and from them to the ground with astonishing ease. They walked rapidly and their legs, very similar to those of our birds, ended in three toes, two forwards and a third, stronger one, extended backwards. I learned that they were house or domestic birds, living on the pavements and also inside homes. Equally nourished by vitamin substances on an equal footing with other citizens. In fact, the residents all keep suitable containers in their flower beds for them where they usually deposit food for them. They are never smaller than our homing pigeons and, as it turns out, have the same habits as them because they never climb trees, bushes or flower beds. It seems to me that they have the instinct not to harm plants or flowers and so unlike our wild birds, they don't destroy or damage vegetation. Intimately familiarized with humans, these birds are loved by everyone and complement the common life of the inhabitants of that enchanting metropolis, even though they are almost always singing in high tones. I found it too strident for my ears as their singing doesn't harmonize or mix with the permanent natural music coming from space. It must be added that the creatures of that strange planet possess a kind of auditory ambiguity that allows them to hear two tunes at the same time without any discomfort. It would be as if we earthlings assimilate, without any confusion, the words of two speakers speaking simultaneously. We continued walking through the trees and arrived at a certain point where there were dozens of little tables equipped with communication screens. These video phones were surrounded by four individual stools. We left this area to enter a huge courtyard, in the center of which I noticed about 30 circles formed by a thin layer of whitish smoke, each containing a person. These circles measured about 3 meters in diameter by about 5 meters high and were like transparent glass tubes, slightly fogged up and constituting real round curtains. Very close to the aforementioned circles of smoke, there were another 60 pillars about 8 meters high, at the top of which we could see a device very similar to the floodlights used on our sports fields. The difference was that in place of the focal glass they had a plate full of orifices. What do those circles represent? Are they prisons? No, said my interlocutor. They are mentally ill people locked inside these chambers formed by gaseous rays, in order to give them appropriate treatment. This way, without hurting them or even interfering with their movements, we make use of beneficial rays projected by the devices placed on top of the columns that flank the chambers, thereby providing them with their treatment. And, without interrupting the subject, he continued, explaining, by means of a curious system, salutary combinations of elements are projected, aimed at the patient's recovery. By receiving such vigorous impacts, they suffer peculiar effects that produce unexpected reactions. This is why these unfortunates struggle, want to escape, threatening to break the chamber with punches, kicking and headbutts. But wouldn't it be better to leave them locked up and immobile than to keep them that way? I inquired with great discretion. Since the reactions hit the patient's brain of these mentally sick ones, they must be unimpeded in their movements, their muscles and nerves free, so that the treatment they receive is not deficient. The compulsory paralyzing of the limbs would negatively there affect nervous and circulatory systems, leading to a serious reduction of the effectiveness of the treatment. I was curious and anxious to find out and anxious to know how those patients were enclosed within the gaseous walls. I received an invitation from Dr. Janzel to follow him. He took me to a kind of bandstand-like podium where, in front of the floor, there was a control panel with numerous levers and, at the top, attached to the panel, a circle the size of an ordinary dish that very much resembled an enormous round screen. In the center of this podium was one of the little tables with its stool and communications display. When we arrived, Dr. Janzel introduced me to the control operator, at the same time telling him something I couldn't fathom. The fact is that the man in charge came up to me and asked me to pay attention to the screen. As I did so, I saw, perfectly and clearly, all those smoke chambers with their respective occupants. Then Dr. Janzel took the video phone headset up from the table and began to stare into the screen, and before long the head of a creature appeared inside the screen and I noticed that he was transmitting something to him. After a quick conversation, the person in focus disappeared and the doctor calmly put the video phone headset back in place on the table. I was intrigued by the fact that, although I had fixed my eyes on the doctor, I hadn't understood anything of what they were transmitting to each other through the screen, headset. Perhaps they were talking in the visual language between them, in other words, in the language of the planet. Embracing me fraternally, Dr. Janzel made me leave the podium in the direction of the sanatorium chambers. At one point, he said to me, "Stop here. Stand there and I'll lock you up in one of those chambers. Don't be afraid because nothing unusual will happen to you." I looked around to see if there was anything abnormal and noticed, on the floor, a concave channel about 2 centimeters long, which bordered a circle full of small holes. The doctor stepped back a little and looked at the control room operator inside the bandstand, who moved a lever on the panel. Immediately, out of a single jet, a transparent cloud formed around me. On the ground beneath my feet, a cloud began to condense with enough force to lift me to a height of 20 or so centimeters. In this way, I suddenly became a prisoner. I started to step on that shapeless mass under my feet and it felt as if I were compressing a bulky mass of cotton wool. You could say it was something gaseous, but at the same time, with a certain degree of expansion. Restless and not very satisfied, I went up against the wall that enclosed me and tried, at first, to break it down with my hands, but inexplicably, the walls returned to its original position. Outside, my friend was looking at me through the cloud wall and from there he told me, "Try to escape from that cloud tube, if you can." I tried to face the flexible wall with my body which resembled a sheet of transparent sheet, but I couldn't do it. To no avail, I applied all my strength on a certain point, using the resources at my disposal to free myself from that eccentric prison. Its walls yielded with greater or lesser intensity to the compression, but returned to their initial position. I was already becoming distressed in the imprisoned condition I found myself in and no longer containing myself, I shouted, "I can't get out of here. There's no force that can break this." With a cheerful smile, Dr. Janzel turned to the control room operator and, of course, in his visual language, asked for my imprisonment to be undone. Disconcertedly, I felt that soft layer under my feet dropped away, and I went down as if I were in a lift. When it disappeared completely and I felt my feet on solid ground, the wall around me disappeared as if it had been sucked through the holes in the channel or diluted in the atmosphere itself. In fact, I certainly felt much more at ease as soon as I found myself outside the cloud cubicle. "You were already apprehensive, weren't you? Wait for me for a moment, That's what Dr. Janzel said to me when he saw me free. Whilst he was chatting to the person in charge of their control, I went round the other. Their occupants, some of them comfortably lounging on the softness of the cloud that took the anatomical shape of their bodies, remained quiet. Others, surprised by my unexpected presence, took up exotic and even hilarious positions.